X-29, number 1B.
Only goes to show that we have not really grasped the import of this chapter. We find ourselves here at the beginning of our way of life. Prayer is the beginning of every approach to God, and the chapter Prayer shows the qualities necessary for such an approach. These qualities are not qualities of old theological belief. Our old concept of prayer must be abandoned. The concept which comprises a dogmatic worship, an outward worship, a habitual pleading with God, asking His pardon, beseeching Him, flooding Him with requests, in short, anything which has an ecclesiastical flavor. Prayer in Christian Science is something which has to do with mentality, with an inward attitude towards God and man. Mrs. Eddy shows that prayers are mental, but what kind of mentality? Not any mentality is able to approach the subject of divinity, and so the purpose of this chapter, prayer, is to clarify what mentality, what mental atmosphere is necessary to attune oneself with God. Without a true approach, we never reach God. Hence, the great necessity for us to understand this chapter. It equips us with the mental qualities needed for our journey heavenward. As I said before, I'm going to talk to you in terms of subjects. Here, the first subject deals with the prayer of wisdom through true desire, mind. It opposes wishful thinking and shows that our desire should to be accept God as He is and not as we wish Him to be. In other words, it is a state of mind where we open our thought to God and are willing to be molded by the divine mind. It is stated that God is unchangeable, and consequently our mentality must be a willingness to change in order to conform to the divine mind. It is not enough to know that we must have pure and true desire. We must also know what such desire implies. The textbook shows us here what constitutes true desire. The subject then changes abruptly to a second one, to the prayer of reflection, through the longing to express divine qualities, spirit. Here is shown that we must express spiritual qualities such as patience, tenderness, meekness, obedience, watchfulness, goodness, and especially gratitude. Great stress is laid on gratitude, on being grateful for God and longing to be Godlike. True gratitude is expressed in being grateful for spiritual things, not for material things. Mrs. Eddy tells us to be grateful for life, truth, and love. This means being grateful for spiritual gain and not for material gain. Usually, people are grateful only for material demonstrations. They have a feeling of gratitude only if they get what they ask for. Well, that is not gratitude. The whole sense of gratitude is a sense of reflection, of being grateful for the fact that God is. And by experience, we learn that if people can attain that point of gratitude, their problems are solved more easily. This sense of gratitude is a wonderful thing, for it shows that gratitude is not dependent on anything except an understanding that God is. This brings us to the third subject, which I have epitomized as the prayer of reformation through the cancellation of sin, soul. This prayer does away with the sense of speculating with God. It shows us that we must have the willingness to reform, to change from sense to soul. It is not asking pardon. It is being willing to correct ourselves. Usually, people think that some certain kinds of prayer, such as long and wordy ones or ritualistic ones, are answered by God. This is nothing but speculation. The third prayer here makes it plain that we have to pay the last farthing for sin, that we can adjust the balance only through the cancellation of sin, through self-abnegation, self-denial, and through affirming our true Christ selfhood. In the fourth subject, we have the prayer of honesty through correction, principle. Here you will find how, in a wonderful way, paragraph by paragraph, Mrs. Eddy depicts the true sense of honesty. She shows that we can speak of honesty when our words correspond with our desires, when our thoughts correspond with our acts, when our outward expression corresponds with our inward feelings. What is presented here is honesty itself, and not merely a moral sense of it, such as not lying, stealing, and so on. The quality of honesty consists in bringing our thoughts, words, acts, feelings, and life into one accord. You can see how this is a very wonderful sense of principle, because it is really the first attempt to demonstrate oneness. The moment there is a discrepancy between one's thoughts, words, acts, feelings, and life, hypocrisy is at work. The fifth subject gives us the prayer for wholeness through deep consecration, life. The question here is, what sort of healing do we want? In what way, through what method, do we want to obtain results? Do we want to have healing through blind belief, through mere petitions, through our own blind faith, through vain repetitions or torrents of words? Do we want to obtain demonstration or results through audible prayer or public worship? If so, this is praying in vain, because the prayer for wholeness must be a prayer of spiritual understanding, coupled with a fervent, habitual desire to know God, deep consecration, devotion, and conviction. A prayer which puts everything into the scale of life. When we read the paragraphs depicting this subject, we get the sense that we cannot get away with halfway measures, that we just must be in earnest and put our whole love into the scale of being, that we just must consecrate our life to that which is real. The moment we realize that we must consecrate our being to God, the bridge is built for the sixth subject, the prayer of spiritual consciousness through the affirmation of spiritual facts, truth. What Mrs. Eddy wants to show us here is that prayer is all a matter of spiritual consciousness, and that the moment we have this spiritual consciousness, prayer is answered. While the preceding subject dealt with the question of what manner of prayer is needed for healing, this subject now goes a step further and describes the form of prayer which actually brings demonstration as being spiritual consciousness. We must therefore be aware of what we have in consciousness. The prayer of consciousness consists in affirming spiritual facts and shutting out error. We must go into the closet and shut the door on error. If we reach that state of consciousness, prayer is answered. Lastly, we come to the seventh subject, to the prayer of deliverance through holiness, love. From now on, the sense of having to pray to God, the sense of asking or beseeching God for something, falls away. Throughout this seventh prayer runs a tone saying, after all, you know that everything is complete, fulfilled, and bounteous, and therefore your prayer should really be praising, glorifying, magnifying God, loftiest adoration. This is the highest form of prayer. It meets all our needs and is exemplified in the Lord's Prayer. For the study of the Lord's Prayer and its structure, I refer the student to Compendium for the Study of Christian Science, number 3. Looking back, we can see that Mrs. Eddy has built up this chapter through the order of the Word. Of course, God impelled her to do so. In other words, we find that mind comes to us in its first motion as true desire, which we have to culture through wisdom. Secondly, we see that spirit as infinite reflection comes in its first motion as a longing to reflect the divine nature. The third subject shows us soul, coming in its first motion as a willingness to reform, as a willingness to give up sin through self-abnegation. Then fourthly, we have principle coming in its first motion as honesty and a willingness to correct mistakes, thus bringing our thoughts, acts, feeling, and life into one accord. Fifthly, we have life in its fatherhood sense, coming in its first motion as the prayer for wholeness, through deep, fervent consecration, through a willingness to consecrate our life to God. The sixth subject is that of truth, coming in its first motion as an affirmation and consciousness of all that is godlike, and the rejection in consciousness of all that is not godlike. Lastly, having seen that prayer is really spiritual consciousness, the realization comes to us that we have not to plead and beg God to do something for us, but that our prayer should be a magnification, a glorification, a supreme adoration of God, and a rejoicing over the facts that are. Thus, we get a sense of love, of fulfillment, of completeness, of salvation. In this way, Mrs. Eddy presents us with the scientific sense of prayer instead of a theological or emotional sense. Scientific prayer appeals to mental, moral, and spiritual qualities and does not build on ecclesiastical, dogmatic, and outward worship. It is in no way ritualistic, but consists of a spiritual process which must go on in thought. Prayer is the desire and willingness to set right one's mental attitude towards God. Now, if we consider these different subjects again, we shall soon notice that the whole chapter, prayer, is concerned with a clarification of one's inner attitude towards God. The chapter shows what qualities are necessary in order to approach God in an intelligent, ordered, and definite way. That is really its main point. Mrs. Eddy does not intend to go much further than this here. She leaves subsequent steps to later chapters. In this connection, she makes a very interesting statement. Prayer cannot change the unalterable truth, nor can prayer alone give us an understanding of truth. But prayer, coupled with a fervent, habitual desire to know and do the will of God, will bring us into all truth. Science and Health 11:27-31. This gives us the key to the whole chapter. What she has presented through these seven subjects is nothing more than what will bring us into all truth. But prayer alone cannot give us an understanding of truth. The textbook has not yet explained the nature of truth nor the operation of truth. So far, it has shown us only how the student can approach truth. At the end of the chapter, we find another interesting statement. A great sacrifice of material things must precede this advanced spiritual understanding. Science and Health 16:1-2. Can you see how this indicates the ordered presentation of the textbook? It shows what must precede and what must follow. So this advanced spiritual understanding of truth must first be preceded by a great sacrifice of material things. Prayer leads us to understanding, but in order to have an advanced spiritual understanding, there must first be a great sacrifice of material things. Again, we read that only as we rise above all material sensuousness and sin can we reach the heaven-born aspiration and spiritual consciousness. Science and Health 16:20-22. In its main line, prayer does not show what material things must be sacrificed. To know that, we must go on to the next chapter, to Atonement and Eucharist. The chapter prayer, therefore, calls for the chapter Atonement and Eucharist, in which the student is presented with the demands of God, which he must meet in order to be at one mind with God. Atonement and Eucharist. Let us move on to the second chapter and see what subjects are presented in Atonement and Eucharist. You will at once feel that quite a different atmosphere pervades these pages. The chapter begins with the statement, "Atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects divine truth, life, and love." Science and Health 18:1-3. Usually, the beginning of each chapter gives the key to the chapter, and this is a typical instance. Mrs. Eddy starts right away with the purpose of the whole chapter, which is to show how, through atonement, man finds unity with God. While prayer showed us the kind of mentality and inward attitude necessary to come into all truth, Atonement and Eucharist presents the essential requirements which have to be met by the student in order to be at one with God. Naturally, from the absolute point of view, man is the Son of God. But from a relative standpoint, from the standpoint of the way of life, we have to claim ourselves the Son of God. This chapter is illustrated mainly through Jesus' works and life. However, we shall find in it no chronological order of our Master's earthly career, and from a historical point of view, it would in fact appear disordered. For instance, some statements Jesus made to the Pharisees may be followed in the text by some references to his trial and crucifixion. And immediately afterwards, we may be taken right back to his teaching and read of his answer to John the Baptist. The text may then mention the birth of Jesus and from there jump straight to the Passover and morning meal, followed again by some statements on Jesus' healing work. Historically, you see, there is no chronological order in the text. But what we have to be very clear about is that the purpose of this chapter is to teach spiritual order. You will soon realize that from a spiritual standpoint, the spiritual story of this chapter presents a clearly ordered sequence. And to illustrate this spiritual order, Mrs. Eddy has taken a number of appropriate incidents and sayings out of Jesus' life. Prayer presented us with the qualities needed for our journey. Here, in Atonement and Eucharist, we encounter the demands of Christ, the demands which Christ makes on us if we truly want to go forward. What are these demands? The first subject shows that atonement demands right and courageous action, mind. So, you see, the way of life is not for mental cowards. Jesus acted boldly, and bold actions are demanded of us in order to atone. We get here a great sense of doing, of acting courageously, precisely as mind demands. It is a demand for mental courage, a fearlessness to act at one mind with God. Having dealt with this subject, Mrs. Eddy now changes abruptly to a second subject, in which she points out that atonement demands purity of thought, demands turning away from matter to the imperishable things of spirit. All through this subject, we get a strong tone of the firmament of spirit demanding separation, a purification of thought. This demand for separation is brought out very clearly. Mrs. Eddy refers to such commands as, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's," and urges us to put aside material self and sense, to turn constantly away from material sense, and look towards the imperishable things of spirit. What we learn in the third subject is that atonement demands going away from sense to soul. Soul. Can you see the logic of this? Whereas in the preceding subject, spirit demanded a purification of thought, soul now demands that we be definite in our intent and actually go away from sense to soul. This requires that we should be resolute, persevering, persistent, definite, firm, constant. As Mrs. Eddy indicates, we should not let ourselves be torn to and fro and swing like a pendulum between matter and spirit, or vibrate between sin and hope. We should pursue our path with constancy of purpose, with firmness and fixity. In those paragraphs, the sense of perseverance is brought out through statements like, "Occupy till I come. Be not weary in well-doing. Go not back to error, nor become a sluggard in the race." We cannot help hearing the call of soul asking us to be spiritually tough and persevering. However, we cannot have just blind perseverance, and the fourth subject immediately breaks in and specifies on what basis we must persevere. It indicates that atonement demands, as a basis of demonstration, an understanding of fundamental scientific facts, principle. We find here that the power of demonstration is rooted in spiritual facts. In other words, our demonstration of principle cannot be founded on human beliefs, theological views, theories, doctrines, forms, or systems of religious worship. Nor can a mere reliance on the personal Jesus be its basis. What principle demands of us is demonstration, based on a knowledge and understanding of God. Individual demonstration thus becomes indispensable and renders a blind trust in Jesus or trust in the experience of other people of no avail. The demonstration that flows from such a scientific basis is spiritual life, not a material sense of life. In the fifth subject, therefore, we see that atonement demands the laying down of a material sense of life, which to human sense appears as persecution, life. Any attempt to bury life in matter is a persecutor. Mrs. Eddy makes here the striking statement that the determination to hold spirit in the grasp of matter is the persecutor of truth and love. Science and Health 28:6-8. Hence, the demand of life is that we lay down our corporeal sense of life, our organic sense of life, our human sense of life, our personal sense of life, in short, any false sense of life. The belief that life is in and of matter will naturally persecute our efforts to follow the demands of spiritual life. And so we shall encounter trials and persecutions. But these should in no way deter us from going on to follow the demands of the Christ. Then, in a very comforting way, Mrs. Eddy brings in a different tone with the sixth and seventh subjects. I am sure that up to this point you must have felt, just as any sincere reader would, that God demands quite a lot from us. First of all, he demands right and bold action, mind. Second, he demands a purification of thought, spirit. Third, he demands that we stick to and persevere in our intent, soul. Fourth, he demands as a basis of demonstration a knowledge of fundamental scientific facts, principle. And fifth, he demands that we lay down a false sense of life, life. At this point, the student might easily feel confronted with an insurmountable task, thinking that it is really too much for him. So, now in a very loving way, it is as if Mrs. Eddy says, "Don't be discouraged. Don't think these demands cannot be met. Don't think you cannot make the grade. It can be done. Jesus did it, and a proper understanding of truth will enable you to do it also." In her sixth subject, she shows that the possibility of man's atonement with God is exemplified in Jesus' life work, truth. So now she gives Jesus' life in a chronological order, from his birth to his ascension, illustrating how Jesus atoned every step of his way. This sixth subject presents no demand of you should or you must. What it conveys is that the demands put forth in the preceding subjects can be met. Jesus is shown as having demonstrated man as the idea of God. Incidentally, the term idea occurs here for the first time in the textbook. Now, this actual atonement with God on Jesus' part revolutionized the world, for the very nature of truth is revolutionary. It makes no compromise with error whatever. Hence, there is nothing else for error to do but to yield, and this is revolutionary. Coming to the last subject, we find a very marked and definite change both in subject and in tone. The seventh subject is very long and takes up half the chapter, which would indicate that particular stress is laid on it. Mrs. Eddy shows in it that atonement is not something we choose to do of our own accord, that it is not a question of tilling the soil, as it were, but that behind it all is the plan of love. My epitome for this last subject is that the design of love enforces atonement, love. Mrs. Eddy pertinently starts right away with the statement, the design of love is to reform the sinner. Science and Health, 35-30. As I have said, we get here quite a different atmosphere, namely, that atonement is impelled by love, that behind atonement is the force of love, wanting to save us, and giving us no chance to escape salvation.